Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Community Shares Utah, connecting donors with causes that matter through workplace giving to Utah charities, including Utah Public Radio and Wasatch Community Gardens. Information is at communitysharesutah.org.
It's England in the winter of 1886, and a young mother is alone. Martha Hughes Cannon is in hiding. She's a physician, but she can't reveal her skill. She's married, but she cannot be near her husband. She's thousands of miles from home because of her lifestyle in polygamy. Martha Hughes Cannon is in exile.
We are everywhere looked upon with suspicion. It is an absolute fact that a woman can't travel here in Europe with a baby unaccompanied by her husband without having that child branded with illegitimacy and herself looked upon as one who has submitted herself to prostitution.
You're listening to a bit of audio from a new KUED-TV documentary that airs this week on the life of Martha Hughes Cannon. You heard Ken Verdoya of KUED, who narrates the documentary, and a reading from Martha Hughes Cannon. It's the subject of the first half of our Access Utah Today. Welcome. I'm Lee Austin, filling in this week for Tom Williams. And we're pleased to have with us in the first half of our program the producer of the Martha Hughes Cannon documentary and one of the scholars featured in the program as well. A program note, later in the program, the second half, we're going to be talking with NPR's Howard Berkus about the upcoming London Olympics. But right now, a look back on the life of Martha Hughes Cannon. And Nancy Green, it's great to have you back on the program. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me again.
And Constance Lieber, you are a scholar and I believe a Martha Hughes Cannon biographer.
I'm working on the biography, yes.
Well, tell me first, I guess both of you, the same question. Martha Hughes Cannon, a significant figure in Utah history. She was a physician, a very unusual thing for a female of her time. The first state senator in the United States, an active suffragette, and a sister wife, which had significant effects on her career and her life. So a lot of us know a little bit about this story. What attracted you to delve deeper and bring this story perhaps to a new audience on KUED?
Well, I think part of it was Ken Verdoya, who did narrate the piece, came into my office one day and said, let's revisit some of the classic Utah history pieces that we've done, and do something along that vein. We've done Ken produced wonderful shows on Brigham Young, Struggle for Statehood. And I looked, and I was looking for some female figures to bring to life in history. And Martha Hughes Cannon came to the fore because of her accomplishments that you mentioned. But I think what really drew me into her was the struggles that she had, that she was a very human person, that she was somebody who dealt with the difficulties of having romantic ideals versus the realities that she was faced with. So I thought her conflicts, her passion, I thought all those were things that really drew me in to telling her story.
And Constance?
Well, you know, she had her letters that she wrote to her husband while she was in exile in England had been misfiled at the Church Historical Department. And some years ago, while I was working as a cataloger there, I came upon them and read them. And I was amazed at this young woman, her resiliency, and the life that she had. And by that, I mean her enthusiasm, her engagement with life, even living under the most difficult circumstances.
And as a historian, you have one obvious challenge in the research. Like many of her time, she kept journals, but when she died, she left specific instructions that they all be burned. So you don't have those.
No, and it's made particularly researching the last part of her life after she had dropped from the national stage very difficult.
Any idea why this directive to have all of her journals destroyed?
Well, you know, even from writing from England already in 1886, she told her husband, burn every letter. She was anxious to leave no trail for some reason. I'm not quite sure. She was quite a mix of a very public person and a very private person. I think she feared perhaps misinterpretation of some of her life choices, which, looking at it today, we do think is rather incredible.
And we will get to those, of course, as we continue our conversation. Reminder, we're talking about the life of Martha Hughes Cannon and a new KUED documentary, which will air Sunday at 8 p.m. and again Tuesday, July 24th at 9 p.m. And we are talking about KUED Channel 7. And this is a live conversation. If you have a question or comment and would like to join the conversation, it's a toll-free call to 1-800-826-1495. Or you can communicate via email. Go to upraccess@gmail.com. Nancy Green, for those who have missed this story, maybe just a brief encapsulation of her early life. Born in Wales, her family were converts to the LDS Church, and they traveled here, a difficult journey to the United States when she was quite young.
Exactly. So she comes over, she's about 4 years old, and they're making the trek from New York to Utah. And it's a difficult time. Her father is desperately ill. She has a baby sister who actually dies along the way. And then just a few days after arriving in Salt Lake City, her father passes away. So I think it's not uncommon that early immigrants, early pioneers had a lot of loss in their family, but it definitely hit Maddie.
She starts to show herself as a person of many interests and of some independence early on.
She was. Utah was a really interesting time when Maddie was growing up, because it was this Victorian era when I think young girls and women certainly their roles were fairly segmented. I mean, you were supposed to be in the home and hearth, and I think Utah was a different case. I think young girls like Maddie were encouraged to stretch their intellect, to think about other avenues of expression. And she took that on. I mean, I think she was just, it's hard to know, but just from her writings and her actions, she seemed like somebody who really embraced learning, who really embraced exploration, and really wanted to make her mark on the world.
She worked in the early version of the news media, so to speak.
She did. She was actually a typesetter, first for the Deseret News and then later the Women's Exponent. She got exposed to a lot of what was happening. And she also got exposed to some of the most prominent Utah women of the time, too.
And there were others, of course.
There were. Eliza Roxy Snow took her under her wing a little bit. It was really a time, I think, for Utah women to find a way to flourish.
Constance, where does this interest in medicine show up first in Martha Hughes Cannon's life?
Well, according to family accounts, it began during that trek to Utah when her sister died, and then in the early days in Utah when she could see people dying, and she, again, according to the family, determined to learn, to come back to Utah, do something to help that.
And so eventually the decision at a fairly young age to leave the state and formally enter the study of medicine.
Yes, and what was interesting is Maddie was not only willing to take a chance, she only wanted to do things the best possible way. For example, she did not choose to enter the various women's medical colleges, but decided to go to the University of Michigan and get her degree there. Women had only been admitted to that university for a couple of years before she arrived. And then she went further to the University of Pennsylvania, where she was the only woman in the auxiliary school of medicine there. So she was not at all afraid to step up and make her mark.
I have another brief audio excerpt from the KUED documentary that illustrates that point. Let's give a quick listen to that.
And you see when women encroach on male-dominated organizations or structures or subcultures that men resist in ways that characterize the participants as not truly women and not truly participants. Then I think there would have been a lot of resistance to Maddie being a physician in the outside world.
Nancy Green, that was the voice of, and I had this written down somewhere, I believe a medical historian.
That is, and a physician. That is Samuel Brown. And he's somebody who's quite accomplished. Wasn't enough to practice medicine. He also decided to study the history of medicine.
So it would be a natural that he'd be interested in Martha Hughes Cannon.
He was, and he's interested in the times, also the cultural attitudes towards medicine. Is something that really, I think, intrigues Sam.
By the way, before we get back to the story, tell me who you did make use of and how you put together the story. Some of the other people that we see.
Some of the other historians are, we have Michael Quinn, we have Catherine Danes from Brigham Young University, who's studied polygamy extensively because polygamy was played an important role in Maddie's life. And we also have Kate Holbrook, who is currently with the LDS Church History Department and in charge of women's studies there. And we have Lisa Tate, who's a wonderful historian who's studied a lot of what was happening for women at the time. And of course, Constance is our wonderful person who can really reflect on what Maddie, what she wrote, what she was going through. And then finally, we really looked to the family to fill in some of the gaps because, as Constance mentioned, with the letters being burned, with only having so much to go by, we also talked to some of the family members who've kept Maddie's history alive. And so Blaine Brady, who's her great-great-grandson and is proud of keeping that heritage alive, we spoke with him.
Well, let's move to the story of Martha Hughes Cannon after she returns to Utah, begins a medical practice, and then decides to marry into a polygamous family, becoming the fourth wife of a much older man, and that has profound effects on her career.
It does. It does. And I think Constance can speak to this, too. But, you know, it's a decision she makes that, if we look back on it today, we question. Here you are, a young woman, pursuing an intense career, obviously very motivated. Why would she then turn around and marry somebody 23 years older than herself and with 17 kids, three other wives? So it's she ends up meeting Angus Munn Cannon. They fall in love, and they get married. And I think, Constance, why don't you pick it up with this notion of why she maybe went into that decision?
Well, I think it could tie into her overall attitude towards life, to do the very best, to get the very best education, to really shine. And in that time, who is the best husband she could have chosen? It would have been a man who was active in the church hierarchy, who had proven himself, as she wrote later, to be spiritual. She wanted that sort of husband rather than what she later termed the untried youth. She had had many suitors, both in Pennsylvania and in Michigan, and broken many hearts. And I think the choice of Angus speaks to her greater goals in life.
I mean, I think one of the things you have to look at, too, is the time. In the 1880s, polygamy was considered the highest form of marriage. And if you look at Maddie as this person who really wants to push the boundaries and do the best, be the best in life, suddenly it starts to make a little bit more sense.
It was also illegal, and the federal authorities were cracking down. He is arrested, and she goes underground.
Mm-hmm. She has to go into exile because on a couple of different levels, she becomes pregnant. She has a baby, and suddenly this child can be used as proof against Angus as the fact that he's in a polygamous marriage. Also, she's a physician. She's delivering babies, so she can be used as a witness against other polygamists. And so she does. She chooses to go leave her career, leave Utah, and go into exile in England.
And Constance, you found letters that she writes back at this time, and she is quite depressed.
Well, she doesn't start out depressed. She sees her journey to England as a great adventure. She has plans to do research so that she can do public lectures when she returns. She has plans to visit hospitals and clinics and learn about the latest teaching methods in Europe. And she plans to see the sights. She writes very excitedly about visiting Shakespeare's birthplace and Warwick Castle and various places. As time wore on, however, the isolation she found herself in and just the separation from the family, those she loved, really wore on her, and she did become depressed.
And if you joined us since we began, we're talking with Nancy Green, a producer at KUED-TV, and Constance Lieber, a biographer, and we're talking about their upcoming documentary, Martha Hughes Cannon. If you want to check out the broadcast, the first run is Sunday at 8 p.m., and then again Tuesday, July 24th at 9 p.m., and we're talking about her life. So eventually, this is kind of, it seems so strange. Now, the warrant for her arrest expires, and she can come back and resume her career, and does so quite successfully.
She does. She picks it back up. She starts again. But once again, she becomes pregnant, and it just seems like this is a pattern in her life, that she resumes her practice, she picks up, trying to pick up where she left off, and then something inside of life, whether it's a pregnancy or persecution, forces her onto another path.
We, of course, have to discuss her political life, which began with the women's vote, which Utah had for a time early, and then it was retracted, and then there was the push for statehood and a Utah constitution that included women's suffrage, and Martha Hughes Cannon was quite a leading figure in that discussion.
She was. She really, she believed in equality. She believed that women could do what men can do. It doesn't mean she thought women and men were the same, but she definitely felt that women could have a political life, that they should vote. She grew up with the vote. She grew up in this environment, and so she took that on full force. She really started talking, speaking publicly, and she became pretty well known inside of Utah. There was a group of women who really were pushing for women's suffrage, for women to get the vote.
And she was known, began to become known well outside of Utah. In 1893, the Columbian Exposition newspapers reported her as one of the brightest proponents of women's suffrage.
We have another little excerpt from the documentary that explores this part of Martha Hughes Cannon's life. Let's give that a listen.
I feel I'm chastened to curb my restless, rebellious spirit that I fear would widely deviate from the true path. I feel that the spark of ambition is not yet dead within, but smolders, ready to burst into flame. Martha Hughes Cannon.
From the Edmunds-Tucker Act in 1887, which revoked women's right to vote in Utah, immediately they began organizing to regain that right. So by the 1890s, when the Utah State Constitution is being written and considered, the Mormon women now have mobilized and agitated for a number of years to regain this right that they had. And there's a sense of, we had this right, it's ours, and we want it back.
And they did so successfully, and the Utah legislature is formed. She is recruited, encouraged to run for the state senate successfully. Nancy?
Yeah, she is. She, because of her, I think, her prominence as a female suffragist, she is encouraged to run. And so she runs on the Democratic ticket. And right up against her was her husband, Angus, who was encouraged to run on the Republican ticket.
That sounds so odd today, but that, in fact, is what happened. She won, her husband didn't.
Exactly. And, I mean, it wasn't the way it is today where they were running neck and neck. The tickets were structured differently. The parties were structured differently. But exactly, she won. Angus didn't. And it would have been really interesting to be a fly on the wall at their dinner conversations that night.
Constance, she was recognized for a number of initiatives in her two terms as a state senator, many of them around public health.
Right, because that was her main interest. For example, she established the State Board of Health. She passed bills to establish the state school for the deaf and the dumb. And then other bills, for example, stools in workplaces so women could sit down from time to time, that sort of thing, things that she would have observed and formed ideas how to help.
And there was talk at one point about maybe a further political career, perhaps moving up the ladder, but again, with the birth of another child, a daughter, that pretty much ended her political career.
Yeah, actually, she, somebody even said we should nominate her for United States Senate, which would have been amazing, because remember, this is before women nationally even had the right to vote. And then she does. She's, she gets pregnant, has another child with Angus, and again, she's sworn to uphold the laws of the land, and here she is still in a polygamous marriage. And it becomes quite the national scandal. There are newspaper articles all across the country talking about this. And, you know, it's proof that the Mormons aren't doing what they said they would do when they said they wouldn't practice polygamy. And it really basically ends her political career. And it shuts down much of her public life, too. I mean, she becomes much more, her life centers much more around family. And it's a much more private life after this point.
She moves to California. She has health problems. Her daughter eventually dies, and she dies, I think, a year later.
She dies a couple of years later, yeah. And Constance, you found that amazing poem that we read inside the show. Talk about that a little bit.
It's an excerpt from a bookly poem by Orson F. Whitney, which is supposed to be a moral tale of a young girl and a young man and trying to find their way in the world. And, of course, since this is meant for a Mormon youth audience, they both found their way within religion to the right point. But at several points within the poem, he writes things that apparently touch a nerve in Maddie. She wrote in the margin, Gwendolyn, and she would put in quotation marks various things. And the family says that when Gwendolyn died is when Maddie started dying. And that's very clear from the little we know about that time of her life. And I think her margin comments in this book of poetry really bear that out.
Well, we are pretty much out of time. Again, the documentary on KUED Channel 7, running this Sunday evening at 8 p.m., and again Tuesday, July 24th at 9 p.m. You can find information on their website, KUED.org. And final question, both of you. So what do we take away from the life of Martha Hughes Cannon? Is she a modern role model? Is she a product of a very unusual time? What's the takeaway?
Well, I don't know if we can really say a modern role model. In other words, someone that we should look to and emulate. What she is a very human female who is trying to make her way. The conflict between rational decisions and romanticism, the conflict with having your family, dedicating yourself to your family, and dedicating yourself to your career. I think we can learn a lot from looking at her life, how to engage with difficult processes in our own.
Nancy?
I think Constance said it best, but really, her story is not her struggles are similar struggles to what we're going through today. Maybe it was a different time, but I think as people, as women, we're still dealing with that balance of family, career, romanticism, you know, idealism and reality. And so I think that in a way it's interesting, although she lived so long ago, her struggles really are still our struggles today.
Thank you very much, Nancy Green, Constance Lieber. We'll look for the documentary coming up this weekend. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up after a commentary, we've got a live conversation with Howard Berkus from National Public Radio. He's packing for London and the Olympic Games. He's had a lot of experience covering the Olympics, including the 2002 Games in Salt Lake City. Stay tuned for that.
Steve Eaton is a freelance writer who lives in Logan. He writes a column that appears in the Deseret News every other Saturday.
The basic necessities that one needs for life support these days are far greater than they were for people in days of yore. Recently, I signed up to go to a two-day training workshop across town. I did not have to sleep overnight, but I was surprised how complicated it was to leave the office during the workday. First of all, my work back in the office would keep coming in, so I needed to be able to check my email during every break. I have the latest and greatest iPhone, so I'd be prepared to answer email right there on my phone. I decided, however, it would be wise to throw in my Bluetooth keyboard so that I could type out a message faster if I needed to. I know that my sophisticated phone is set up so that you can just dictate your email right into it, but the robo lady Siri doesn't like me and has practically told me so to my face. Siri, do you like me? I asked once when we were alone. I'd rather not say, Steve, she responded, acting as if she couldn't wait to get off work. I realized, however, that to answer some emails, I might need to draw from other documents in my computer, so I decided to pack my laptop. Then I remembered how hard it can be to boot up a laptop during the break, so I decided to bring along the iPad my son gave me, too. I made sure I brought the Bluetooth keyboard that he bought for it, just in case it's too hard to type on the letters on the iPad screen. Of course, I had to bring the backup power cords for all these devices, so I had to wrap each of them carefully and squeeze them into my backpack. It was like a puzzle, only a puzzle with lots of cords. I really wanted to get all I could from the conference, so I decided to bring a small digital recorder, even though my phone is equipped with several recording applications. I don't yet know exactly which one works best or what Siri might do to them. I knew I had a cassette recorder in the car to back me up if my digital recorder failed me. Then I remembered what a pain it can be to transcribe notes, so I decided I needed to bring my Live Scribe pen. This fancy pen can also record, but to use it properly you need special paper, so I slotted in some of its special notebooks. The advantage of using this pen, which records too, is that instead of transcribing, you merely touch the pen to your notes, and it plays not just the sounds you were hearing when you took the notes, but the sound of your pen frantically scratching on the special paper. It's good to have as a backup in case your digital recorder, cassette recorder, and cell phone fail you. Since I was sort of traveling loose and free that day, I didn't check to be sure my Bluetooth headset was in my backpack, but I was pretty sure it was there, along with my walkie-talkie that I always carry with me, because I'm part of the neighborhood disaster attack team. In fact, I'm a blockhead with lots of responsibility. I also left my Strong Idea head spa at home because I know it can disturb others who take pills for headaches. It is this large, helmet-like vibrating thing that does look like something that was stolen off the set of Battlestar Galactica, and there's really no way I could have fit it into my backpack. I just packed in some Excedrin along with my Fix Your Memory drugs and Afternoon Purple Paranoia pill. The last two are made up with all natural ingredients that Mother Nature herself came up with so that people can have safe pills to buy. I forget what the ingredients are, but I know the government doesn't want anyone to know about them. The seminar was one where we talked about a management philosophy that tries to eliminate waste and simplify things for the workers and the customer. They taught us of a lean approach that's designed to make workers more efficient and is aimed at helping people learn how not to waste time investing in things that don't really move them toward their goals. I was glad that I had come prepared but not overdone it. Everything I needed I had squished into a single backpack that is specially designed for people who carry electronic devices with them into the great outdoors. Other people came to the seminar with nothing and had to use the free pen and notebook the seminar people provided, but I knew they were unprepared for the day. I felt pretty good about myself. After that first day, as I left the building, I found myself softly singing the Jungle Book hit, "Look for the Bare Necessities." I tried to mimic the happy swagger of the carefree bear Baloo, but unfortunately my backpack was so heavy I lost my balance and fell into some thorny shrubberies in front of the place. "What can I help you with?" Siri asked from my pocket. "Siri, I'm hurt," I said, wanting at least sympathy. "Steve, I don't understand. Siri, I'm hurt," she said, pretending to be dumb. Then my mood really changed and it started to rain. That's when I realized I'd not only forgotten to pack a first aid kit, but I'd left my portable poncho at home, along with my electric hand warmers. This is Steve Eaton.
And you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in this week for Tom Williams, and we shift our attention now to the upcoming Olympic Games in London. Olympic events have, in a sense, become a Utah story since the Salt Lake City Games many years ago. Howard Berkus is the NPR correspondent based in Salt Lake City. He has a number of roles, including a rural affairs correspondent, and has worked in the investigative unit, most recently reporting on black lung in the coal mining industry. But he's getting ready to pack for London, perhaps has done so already, and will be reporting on the Olympics. Howard Berkus, it's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me, Lee. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, a coincidence I'm filling in. We once get to speak outside of one of the on-air pledge drives.
We've done that before.
Well, have you kept count now? How many Olympic competitions have you reported on for NPR?
This will be, hold on just a second here.
Yeah.
This will be my eighth Olympics for NPR.
That's quite a record, and it gives you an interesting insight into the games, the politics, the nationalism, the venue, the athletic parts of it. Are there aspects that interest you most, or all of the above?
Well, I first started covering the Olympics in the 1980s. I did two games in the 1980s, none in the 1990s. And then with the Salt Lake Olympic bribery scandal, which I heavily reported, I got back into sort of the Olympic realm again. And mostly I was interested in the politics of the games, of the International Olympic Committee, Olympic sponsors. But now having covered six games with London now in this decade, in the last decade, I've become interested in the athletes and the sports as well, and I'm more interested in the under the radar athletes and sports. Although I will end up covering swimming in London as I did in Beijing, and that'll all be about the big stars, and that's fun too, and that's great and interesting, but. For me, what I get most excited about is, you know, discovering the athlete off the radar who does something completely amazing or is about to break out as a star, and the sports that don't often get much attention but have athletes who struggle to survive, to get money, to scrape enough money together to compete, and do amazing things despite the fact that we don't hear about them very much.
And a lot of those stories you don't discover until the games begin.
Right, but you know, in May, I went to a U.S. Olympic Committee event in Dallas where we media were introduced to hundreds of Olympic athletes from Team USA, and you know, the Gabby Douglas, who finished first in the U.S. Olympic trials recently for gymnastics, this you know, 16-year-old pixie-ish African American. A gymnast from Virginia Beach, Virginia, is poised to be the next big star for the American women gymnastics team. And she really captured everybody's interest and attention in Dallas at this event we were at. And sure enough, she then finished atop the Olympic trials. And she'll be one of the big stories, I think, of the Olympics. Again, somebody who, unless you're like completely obsessed with gymnastics is off the radar.
Howard Berkus from NPR in Salt Lake is with us. He's headed for London to cover the Olympic Games. With us live for about another 18 minutes or so, if you have a question or would like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-826-1495 or send us an email to upraccess@gmail.com. A lot to cover here. Just a question, those may be interested. Covering the Olympics is a pretty demanding thing to do, kind of an Olympian event. You're working with odd hours, different time zones, a lot of show requirements, and I don't think you have a lot of time for fun and side activities in London.
No, we work, 23, 25 days straight, often without any time off, 12 to 20 hour days, with a few all nighters in there, and the show demands are immense. Plus, we have web duties as well, writing for the web, and so for NPR.org, where we'll have a intensive Olympics coverage. So it's a lot, and my first Olympics in 1984. We had 7 NPR reporters and editors. In London, we'll have 4, 3 reporters and 1 editor. But the demands are much greater. The games are much bigger. So it's an intense time. But none of us complain. You're there. You want to work. You want to be at every event you can be at. You want to report as much as you can. We may get a little testy during the Olympics as the pressure increases and as the sleep deprivation grows and as the food in the main press center wears on us. But it's absolutely a privilege, to be there, and you won't hear any of us complain about it.
Each Olympics seems to have a set of issues or themes or things that get reported on. Of course, Salt Lake Games were the bid scandal games, and then they became the post 9/11 games, and now they're the games a presidential candidate is using on his resume. What are some of the themes from London? One that I hear a lot about are security concerns.
There have been security concerns. London has been a target of terrorism recently, major terrorism, and so the security there is even much, much more intense than it was in Salt Lake for the 2002 Olympics, which closely followed the September 11th attacks. They have anti-aircraft missile batteries on apartment buildings in London, and there have been some problems with the security arrangements so far. They've had to call up some armed forces, some military troops to fill in because they weren't able to hire enough private contractors. I think though so far this may become known as the soggy games. It has been raining mercilessly in London for the past month or so, even more than it usually does, and even Londoners are now complaining about the rain. And the forecast is not good. More rain on the cooler side. Athletes kind of like that kind of weather. That's for many, for track and field at least, and some other outdoor sports. Cooler and wetter isn't bad necessarily, but that could be one of the early stories. Is the rain, the intense rain, and how much that affects the games, but I always say in advance of an Olympics that something will happen that none of us can predict that will be, it will just have our attention. We'll be just glued to the TV, glued to the radio, wanting to learn more about, an athlete who comes out of the woodwork and does something completely amazing, or a scandal of some sort that disappoints everyone. That happens almost every Olympics, and that's why it's exciting to cover the games and to watch them.
People always wonder how the host city will be prepared, what the venues will be like, how traffic will get around, how logistics have been managed. Any indication going into these games, how London has done?
Well, the venues are ready. They've done a great job with venues. They've spent an enormous amount of money, and they've spent a lot of time, and there was no last-minute rush to complete venues like there was in Athens, for example. But the biggest question, I think, in terms of the staging of the games is transportation. You know, London has a transportation system that is known for being blocked and clogged and crowded in the best of times. The demands on that system will be greater than ever. Heathrow has already had its biggest day ever in terms of people going through the airport, and that will only increase as more and more athletes and reporters and spectators, you know, go through London.
How are Britons engaged in the games? I assume anywhere a host city is making a bid, some people are excited, some people less so. People are excited about various athletes and their team's chances, and there is always a degree of nationalism. What is the mood?
Well, you know, I haven't been there yet.
Yeah.
I don't know. I hear bits and pieces from our correspondent in London and in news stories that I read, and it seems, and again, this is typical. This is so typical before an Olympics, is there's a mix of, you know, excitement and dread. Dread about the traffic. Dread about terrorism possibilities. Dread about just so many people being in the city. And what typically and how the city will be, you know, portrayed to the world. And what typically happens is that the traffic is better than everybody thinks it will be. The transportation works better than everybody thinks it does. And a lot of people leave town, a lot of locals leave town to avoid the mess, which then actually makes it a fairly pleasant place to be, you know, during the Olympics. In 1984 in Los Angeles, there was no smog during the Olympics, no freeway backups at all. Los Angeles was a dream place to be during the games, and that's because a lot of people left town. Businesses had telecommuting going on, you know, people working from home. They set up satellite offices in the suburbs, and it was quite pleasant. Commuting was easy. The sky was clear. So we'll see what happens in London. Often it's not as bad as people, you know, worry that it will be. And as far as the city's reputation, that'll depend on what happens, you know, during the next month. We'll see.
Yes, who can forget all the concerns about the Salt Lake Winter Games? What would the snow conditions be like? Would there be winter inversions? Would there be security issues? What would they think of the Mormon Olympics? Those sorts of thoughts.
And you know, Salt Lake, despite the scandal, Salt Lake came away from those Olympics with a reputation for having organized one of the best organized Olympics ever, and having, you know, among the friendliest people you could ever encounter at an Olympics in terms of the volunteers and the organizers. So all in all, despite the scandal, it ended well for Salt Lake in terms of its reputation.
And Mitt Romney does use this on his resume.
He's not only using it on his resume, he's using it to fundraise. The night before the games begin, Mitt Romney has two fundraisers in London, $75,000 a plate to have dinner, you know, with Romney, and I think it's a couple of thousand dollars, $1,500 to attend another fundraiser in London. So he's using his Olympics connection, absolutely. He continues to use that, and you know, in the Olympic world, there are people who remember him very fondly, and the Americans among those people, many of them, some of them are in London. He's going to tap, you know, their wallets for his presidential campaign.
More fun to talk about Olympics than Bain Capital, I guess.
I think this will raise. I think this will help keep the Bain Capital issue alive, though, because there is that question of how much did Mitt Romney control Bain Capital while he was running the Olympics? You know, the campaign says he had nothing to do with Bain Capital once he arrived in Salt Lake. you know, filings with the SEC still list him as the principal owner and manager of Bain Capital through the Salt Lake Olympics, and he says he didn't have anything to do with it. But appearing at a fundraiser tied to the Olympics in London, I think only, you know, will keep this alive.
Back to the games. Howard Berkus, by the way, with us live on the phone for a little bit longer, talking about the upcoming Olympic Games. Again, some of us through the lens of the Salt Lake game are perhaps more familiar with winter games and skiing and things Utah is known for. What are typically the big events, of course, the opening closing ceremonies, at these upcoming summer games?
Well, swimming is huge, and it starts right off. The morning after the opening ceremony, four gold medals will be awarded, and it's like that almost every day, you know, through the first week of the games. And the big story there is the rivalry between Michael Phelps and Ryan Lochte. Phelps has made it clear that this is his last Olympics. He could become the most decorated Olympian of all time if he again wins a flock of medals like he did in Beijing. But Ryan Lochte has been swimming better than Phelps in the last year, and stands to make his own mark on the Olympics. And then you have 17-year-old Missy Franklin from Denver, who is the next big American women's swimming star for the United States. She's entered in a whole bunch of events, and so swimming right off the bat. Gymnastics, you've got a new crop of gymnasts. Nastia Lukin is gone, Sean Johnson is gone. You have Gabby Douglas and others now trying to continue that tradition of excellence for American women's gymnastics. In track and field, you have probably one of the fastest 100-meter fields ever. In terms of the athletes, and you have an amputee who will run in the 400-meter event at the Olympics, first time that's ever happened, Oscar Pistorius running on prosthesis legs.
There are always the lesser attended or focused on games. I know a lot of people had fun with curling at the Winter Olympics. Is there a comparison in the summer games?
Well, always there are off-the-radar sports that I think deserve attention. Keep an eye on badminton in London. There is an American, became an American, an Indonesian, who won a gold medal in Sydney at the Sydney Olympics in badminton and could win the first medal ever in badminton for the United States. This is not your backyard badminton. That thing travels at 200 miles an hour, and people who've been hit in the eye have required corrective surgery. It's a fast and dangerous sport, and amazing on the Olympic level. I think there'll be there are other trampoline, a relatively new sport to the Olympics. The women have been trying harder and harder and harder tricks on the trampoline, really, really pushing the edge of the envelope. That's an event that will have you holding your breath. And there's so many sports that are considered minor sports that only get, you know, attention at the Olympics that are worth paying attention to because they are as amazing as gymnastics, track and field, or swimming.
Can you promise to file at least one story on badminton?
I have it on my story list to cover badminton, who knows what will happen once we get there. I can't, nothing's guaranteed, but especially if the American men's doubles team does well, you know, we'll be there for that. I would love to sit in on some badminton.
On a more serious note, Howard, it's obvious that what makes the story big here in the United States is how the United States team does, but it shouldn't be the only story, and it shouldn't entirely be through that kind of national lens. Is it a difficult call on what to cover and just not make it all about the U.S. medals count?
I think our coverage is never about the U.S. medals count. I mean, we do mention that, especially in our newscasts, and we, you know, we'll include that in some stories, but we have a broader view. We're interested in athletes from all over the world. We're interested in people who do amazing things no matter where they come from, and we know our listeners are interested in that as well. We have a challenge sometimes in pronouncing their names. We're constantly calling the Olympic committees of other countries to get, you know, to get appropriate pronouncers for people's names that we're not used to. But you'll hear a lot from us about athletes from all over the world.
When do you leave?
Tomorrow morning. I'll be there setting up our office on Thursday and Friday. And then the entire team NPR will be in place and working on Monday.
Well, especially then, appreciate your finding a little niche of time today to share your insights with us. Howard Berkus, the Salt Lake City-based NPR reporter, rural affairs correspondent, and recently you've been hearing him report on the coal industry and black lung disease. An entire shift now to the Olympics, headed to London tomorrow. Howard Berkus, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thanks for your interest.
Safe travels. Good luck. And thanks for joining us on our Tuesday edition of Access Utah. I'm Lee Austin, filling in for Tom Williams. Thanks for joining us. Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio is brought to you by Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater in Logan, with an epic presentation of J.S. Bach's masterpiece, The Sacred Music of Sacred Music, St. Matthew's Passion, August 8th, featuring symphony soloists and the American Festival Chorus conducted by Craig Jessup. Details are at the utahfestival.org.